those of you who were at the press conference last night, some of the introductory remarks I'll make will be a repeat. So let me first, on behalf of Exxon, wish to express our regrets for the anxiety and inconvenience caused by the grounding of Exxon Valdez. I want to assure everyone that Exxon is mobilizing all available resources to mitigate the impact from this incident. Exxon has assumed full financial responsibility for the incident. Our response team is now operational, and during the course of today, we will assume control of all response activities from Alyeska. Right now, we have two very important objectives, and they're going on simultaneously. The first is to move as aggressively as we can to collect or disperse the oil currently on the water. And we recognize that time is critical. Secondly, at the same time, we need to move as cautiously as we dare to remove the oil from the damaged vessel and then to salvage the vessel. In this regard, safety is paramount since we must not spill any further oil. We don't want to complicate our problems, so we're going about that one very, very carefully. Once we have eliminated the threat to the environment and to the vessel, then we will complete a thorough investigation as to the specific cause of the incident, and we have all the same questions you do at this stage. The vessel is still aground on Bly Reef, about 1 mile east of the inbound traffic lane. About 30% of the vessel's bottom is resting on a flat shelf area, about 36 feet below the surface of the water. Our best assessment is that 8 of the vessel's 13 cargo tanks have been breached. The initial underwater survey completed last night by local divers indicated that there are 6 to 8 openings in the underwater body, large enough for a person to swim into, plus a number of open seams from an inch to a couple inches in width. We are planning a full underwater video survey this afternoon, and that'll give us a much more detailed perspective of the damage. We completed a detailed survey of the liquids remaining on board the vessel. That was completed at 11 o'clock this morning. Based on that assessment, we believe approximately 240,000 barrels of oil have escaped from the vessel. Most of that escaped immediately following the initial grounding incident. Let me just make an editorial comment here. This measure of how much oil is on the vessel or has escaped from the vessel, it's not an exact measurement because 8 of the tanks have both oil and water in it. So you have to make an assessment of where the cut line is, what we call the oil-water cut line. And of course, that's not a very fine line. In each of these 8 tanks, on the top, there is a significant layer of oil. On the bottom, it's water. And in between, there's an oil-water layer mixture. So getting an exact measurement of the amount of oil that's still on board is not an exact science at this point. But we did a very, very careful survey during the morning, and as a result of that, we now believe that 240,000 barrels of oil have left the ship, and approximately 1 million barrels of oil remain on board. We had an aerial survey this morning. I was not up, but a number of our people were. The main slick area, as I understand it, covers approximately 2 square miles just south of the stranded vessel. There's a much larger area which is intermittently covered, and that is an area of about 10 to 12 square miles. And of course, this again is not an exact science, but that's the best determination they could make at about 9 o'clock this morning when they were up. The slick appears to be moving slowly southward in Prince William Sound. There are some streaks of oil that have moved further south of the main impacted area. Last night I mentioned both the experts that are being mobilized and also the equipment that's being mobilized, so let me update you on that. There currently are about 40 oil spill response experts that have arrived in Valdez, and they are now being organized into Exxon's casualty response team. There are 9 Exxon managers in that group of 40, and each of those managers will be taking responsibility for certain specific areas of the response. There are 20 trained Exxon supervisors. These people are trained in oil spill response. I mentioned last night that last October we had a 2-day training exercise, and it's something we do periodically to keep people well-trained for this sort of eventuality. So there's 9 managers and 20 supervisors. Each of the supervisors will be taking a specific function. We also have approximately 15 outside experts that we have mobilized from all over the U.S. and also from the United Kingdom. These are experts in different facets of oil spill response. We also have mobilized 40 experienced equipment operators from around Alaska, and as of this morning we began mobilizing local work crews from the Valdez area. We also have set up a claims management team. There's an Exxon coordinator heading that team. We have one outside company, Crawford & Company, which will be assisting with claims handling, and we're also bringing in other firms to help as necessary. On the equipment side, the C-130 spray plane arrived in Anchorage 6 o'clock this morning. The plane is now loading dispersant and awaiting orders. There is the DC-8 cargo jetliner arrived last night with the skimming equipment and communications equipment from the Clean Bay Co-op in San Francisco. There is a second spray plane which is in the air and is due to arrive in Alaska this afternoon. There is also a C-130 in the air loaded with backup dispersant. It also will arrive this afternoon. There is a 707 coming in from London. It is loaded with special skimming equipment and oil storage equipment. There are 2 707s on standby in Houston, and they will await the decision as to whether the major emphasis will be placed on dispersing the slick or mechanical cleanup. So those two planes will provide the backup capability and will shuttle in either dispersant or mechanical equipment depending upon what the initial tests show. Now, I'll talk about those tests a little bit more. The activities going on now, I mentioned that one of our very first concerns is for the 1 million barrels that's still aboard the vessel. We need to get that oil off the vessel. Unfortunately, we have not been able to move anywhere near as quickly as we would have liked. The problem has been the damaged condition of the vessel. Recognizing the position the vessel is in, we have carried out a very detailed assessment of the remaining stability of the vessel. That assessment is not complete. We really need that diver's video survey, and we also need to run some more computer programs on different loading conditions. We started the operation. The Exxon Baton Rouge, by the way, is alongside the Exxon Valdez. That occurred last night. Once the vessels were tied up, at that point both crews were very tired, so we decided to give them a full night's rest. We started a transfer operation this morning, and using the Exxon Valdez's cargo pumps, and we shut down very quickly because it looked like as we started there was more oil beginning to leave the vessel. So we were not at that point clear whether that means that the piping main in the bottom of the tanker is also ruptured, and if that's the case, then that would explain why oil is showing up in releasing the ship or leaving the ship as we try to pump into the Baton Rouge. That may be one possibility. The other possibility may be that it was just oil entrapped under the vessel and it was released. So we need to go through a careful survey to make sure we understand what we have before we go any further. Last thing in the world we want to do is to endanger the vessel and the remaining million barrels that's on board. While we are going through that assessment, we are also bringing in portable pumps in case we have to remove oil from the damaged cargo tanks by lifting it over the top. So, and I believe the Coast Guard salvage pumps are part of that. I believe there's three pumps that came in with the strike team, and we also have two more available. So we are proceeding cautiously. We clearly do not want to make a mistake as far as the vessel salvage goes. We've got a million barrels that we need to be very, very careful with. I mentioned last night the Exxon San Francisco would be coming into the area. It is anchored in the general area of the vessels. And once the Baton Rouge has finished her loading, we'll begin to load to San Francisco. But right now, we're taking great care in assessing this situation a little further before we go forward with that. We've also asked a Smith salvage expert to come in from Rotterdam, and he should be here tomorrow, and to see whether he could offer any advice to us. We are booming the leading edge of the spill to contain the major segment as much as we can and prevent further spread. There's one boom of 5,700 feet being displayed. There's also another boom of 7,000 feet which is being put out, and we're trying to corral the leading edge of the main slick. We've also got 22,000 feet more of boom that will be arriving this afternoon and will be deployed. And the main emphasis will be on corralling that slick as best that we can. At the same time, we are planning a dispersant test this afternoon to test the effectiveness of the dispersant. Part of our problem, you know, it's such beautiful weather, but I hate to say that it is a problem for us as far as dispersant. It's ideal weather for the lightering activity that we need to carry on. So we just can't have it both ways right now. We're also planning an ignition test this afternoon to see if we could entrap small areas of the spill and ignite it. There is a meeting of the regional response team, which includes the EPA and the state authorities, and they're meeting right now. They had a meeting at 12 o'clock also, and they'll be discussing both the dispersant test and the ignition test. But as it stands right now, we hope to test both of these alternatives this afternoon. And based on those two tests, it will tell us a lot about how we proceed from here. Whether we concentrate on dispersing the slick, igniting it, or whether we have to resort to mechanical cleanup. And I say resort because that certainly will be the slowest process that we can go through. We will be taking steps to begin to protect the most sensitive areas, and at 2 p.m. this afternoon there's a meeting planned with representatives of the different fishing groups to help us define the most sensitive areas and areas that we need to prioritize and protect from further spread of the spill. Those are all the comments I had. Steve, do you want to, Commander, would you like to pick up and
This is a live broadcast from the Valdez Civic Center in Valdez, Alaska. This is a press conference produced by Exxon Company. The man who's been speaking is Jack Irasi, president of Exxon Shipping.
I think let's let the commander talk, and then I'll come back for questions.
Jack Arasi is introducing Commander Steve McCall of the U.S. Coast Guard, and he says he'll take questions after Commander McCall makes his presentation again. This press conference is coming to you live from the Valdez Civic Center in Valdez, Alaska. Commander Steve McCall of the U.S. Coast Guard.
Facts, as we know them so far, have just been explained. My name is Commander Stephen McCall. I'm the Federal On-Scene Coordinator for Prince William Sound, and have the federal responsibility to ensure that the cleanup of the released oil is done as expeditiously and as efficiently as possible. I am also the captain of the port for the area, and my concerns in that area lie with the safety of the port itself and the salvage of the vessel. To date, the Coast Guard has a lot of resources on scene and en route to provide assistance in the areas where we have expertise and to where we can help out best. There are three helicopters in the area, some in Valdez and some in Cordova. There's a 378-foot Coast Guard cutter, the Rush, which is on scene in Prince William Sound, basically providing picket duty and command and control presently enforcing the FAA's 6 mile by 3,000 foot limited flight area over the vessel. The Coast Guard Pacific Area Strike Team has had personnel arrive on scene with equipment, and that equipment is in Valdez, and it's being transported by helicopter out to the Exxon Valdez. There is Coast Guard cleanup experts en route and on scene also, and Coast Guard investigators are on board the vessel at this time. One additional piece of information is that tomorrow morning, representatives of the National Transportation Safety Board will be arriving to conduct their investigation into the cause surrounding the causes of the casualty. I don't have any other prepared or information. I'll be glad to field questions probably after Mr. Arasi.
Jack Arasi, okay, president of Exxon Shipping, is returning to the podium.
Is that gentleman gone?
I have a question.
Okay.
The Alaska Commissioner of Environmental Conservation said today that he expressed his anger of what he called the inadequate and delayed response by either Alyeska or Exxon into the spill. He cited specifically 21,000 feet, I believe, of boom that was not deployed, the pledge in the containment plan that you would respond within 5 hours, which did not occur, that there were supposed to be 7 skimmers operating and only 2 were in operation, and a third was on a barge not being used, the bigger one. What do you say to that?
I really can't answer that. I think perhaps Alyeska would have to answer.
Can someone answer that now?
Sure.
Chuck O'Donnell, superintendent of the Marine Terminal.
I'm Chuck O'Donnell, the terminal superintendent for Alyeska Pipeline Service Company. The specific plan that you referenced is our oil spill contingency response plan for Prince William Sound. And as a portion of that plan, it calls for the simultaneous mobilization of different resources. Unfortunately, in this event, we had sustained some damage to a flat deck barge that had one of those skimmers on it. And we had to go through the process of taking all the equipment that had been taken off the barge and put it back on to get it ready to go to sea. 2 weeks ago, during the high winds that we had here at Valdez, we had very sustained winds, 80, 90 miles an hour. And the rest of the skimmers are a portion of that barge package. There are Camaro mini skimmers, there's Vicoma C skimmers, then there's a Class 5 Marco skimmer and a Class 7 Marco skimmer that go out as a part of that deployment package. And those vessels, like I say, were delayed approximately 5 hours while it took us to put all the equipment back on the barge.
You were unprepared?
No, I don't think so. We had looked at it as being a 2 to 3 hour operation, which is normally the case, except for yesterday just happened to be a company holiday in which people were off, and it took us an additional 2 hours to get those people back to the terminal.
Is there something in the contingency plan that says when there's a company holiday, you can delay?
No, sir.
Thank you.
what you know about the cause to this point?
Yes. We started our own informal investigation this morning. That's still going on. We know the following. The vessel was proceeding outbound with about 1.26 million barrels of oil. She had requested permission to move from the outbound lane to the east side of the traffic pattern, which is the inbound lane, in order to avoid heavy ice that was coming off of the Columbia Glacier. She had let the pilot off and was proceeding south. The vessel was fully operational. All propulsion, steering, and electronic systems were fully operable. At that point, that's as far as we know. Our own investigation and an interview of people started this morning, and of course those are the same people that are being used for the survey of the vessel and the lightering and all the other activities. So it's just not possible to closet people. We have to get to them interspersed with the activities that are going on to remove the oil from the vessel, and we have put the priority, and we think correctly, on getting that oil off. So our priority is to salvage that cargo that's still on the vessel. And intermittent with that, as we can get people and discuss it with them, we have we had two people aboard this morning. I'm not sure how many are on now.
Sir, given what you've said, it would indicate that the only possible cause after what you've mentioned, seeing as you eliminated mechanical failure, is some kind of human error.
You could arrive at that conclusion, but I think it's very important not to speculate at this point. The NTSB will begin their formal investigation very soon, and within a matter of a day or two, I'm sure they will have a very clear assessment. The Coast Guard investigation, their informal investigation has been underway. They're on the vessel talking to some of the same people we are, and our informal investigation is also underway. You know, I think once you, I think your perception is correct, once you assure yourself that the vessel was operating correctly, then it really narrows down the focus of the cause.
What is the pilot told the investigators initially that he or she believes is the cause?
I don't know. We haven't spoken to the pilot.
Nobody's spoken to the pilot yet?
I didn't say nobody. I say we, Exxon, have not interviewed.
Who has interviewed the pilot?
I don't know.
What is the pilot's name?
Don't know that either. But the pilot wasn't on board when it occurred. The pilot had been dropped off the vessel some roughly 50 minutes before the actual incident. The incident occurred about 8 miles down the traffic lane from the point where they normally drop off the pilots.
Does this mean you don't know who was steering the ship?
Well, the ship was under Exxon control. At that point, the pilot had been dropped off.
Who was steering the ship? The captain or another officer?
I really don't know that.
What does the crew tell you about what went wrong?
Our people that are asking the questions and doing the investigation are doing that right now.
Are you deliberately shielding yourself from knowing this so you wouldn't have to tell us?
Oh, we intend to tell you everything we know. There would be no reason to shield it. It's going to come out in the NTSB study and the Coast Guard hearing. So there's no way I could shield anything, folks.
Sir?
In fact, what I'm going to do is make sure I tell you before anybody else does.
Sir?
You know, so you could take that as a fact. It would be my job to tell you first before they tell you. I couldn't do it any other way. No, we're far from really having assessed damage or cause. We'll need to wait until we really get an assessment of what's going on. Hopefully that'll be later today, and maybe by tonight I'll be able to tell you a little more.
Sir.
Well, believe me, I'm going to be the first one to tell you. Yes.
My name is Bill McFeeters.
Yes, Bill.
And I represent Labor's Local 341 in the state of Alaska.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you were going to use people from the state of Alaska to help on the cleanup and go through the Union Hall.
We are certainly going to use people from the state of Alaska. I don't know what arrangements are being made to do that.
I'd just like to let you know that we do have people trained in that area, and if you do need help, we'd like a little bit of a advance notice, though.
Okay.
But we do have people.
I think there is an outside organization in town doing the hiring for us.
Who's that?
I don't know the name. Vico? Is that what someone's Vico? Okay.
Vico?
Yes, ma'am. Normal crew is 20, and there were 20 on board. Yes? Let me just gentlemen understand it. Yes?
I have a question for, I guess, the Coast Guard. Do they maintain a radar watch on all incoming and outbound tankers till they get past outside into the Gulf?
The Valdez Coast Guard has a vessel traffic service, which has two radar sites, one in Port Valdez and one at Potato Point, which, depending on what range you set on the radar, extends out to approximately 12 miles from Potato Point. We do not have radar coverage out all the way out into the Sound and all the way out into Hinchinbrook Entrance. We have radio communication sites throughout Prince William Sound that provide radio coverage for the Sound and beyond into the Gulf of Alaska. As you may know, a lot of weather, a lot of conditions affect the quality of radar. So, however, this night was a very clear night. Not very clear. There was cloud cover, but reported visibility was 10 miles, and it was beyond that at the water surface. There was light winds. It was calm. The vessel, as was mentioned about the pilot, that might be a little point to elaborate on. Federal regulations require pilots on inbound vessels at certain areas. For the Valdez area here, the pilot station is at a location called Rocky Point, in from this Bligh Reef. And the main reason for the pilot station there and for the concentrated radar coverage that we provide is for transiting in and out of Valdez Narrows. One of the major concerns as far as navigational hazards, Middle Rock, that's located in Valdez Narrows. And also for providing information to the inbound vessels, whether they be tankers, ferries, or freighters, of other vessels in the area. So we provide a service to the tankers as far as radar coverage. To answer your question specifically, once that vessel had cleared the pilot station and was entered into the traffic lanes departing, he was not under constant radar coverage, as there were no other vessels in the area. He was in an area, entered an area where, as he dropped the pilot, the distance from bank to bank was over 3 miles, and then as he entered into the Sound, it expanded out to over 6 miles.
Commander Steve McCall of the U.S. Coast Guard, Commander McCall, Chuck O'Donnell, the superintendent of the Alaska Marine Terminal, and Frank Arossi, president of Exxon Shipping, are answering questions at this press conference live from Valdez.
No, the vessel was not, at that point in time, after the pilot was departed, the radar watch standard did not have the vessel under constant radar surveillance as it had entered into the traffic scheme and was departing Prince William Sound.
Was the radar mast blind?
It's not mandated, not mandatory according to the VTS traffic rules.
If it had been under surveillance, it would have probably avoided this whole situation.
I couldn't say that.
Was the radar scale set to the level where the operator, if there was an operator watching the screen, could have or did observe the ship? If you ask.
Those are the questions that will be resolved and answered by the National Transportation Safety Board, the particulars. I just say those are the ones that'll be answered.
My name is Jack Lamb. I'm with Cordova District Fishermen United. And on the topic of the radar and this whole situation here, it would be assumable on my part, and I've been in the fishing industry here for nearly 20 years, that when a tanker radios and asks permission to deviate from his designated tanker lane, that at least the line of communication would be kept up, and if nothing else at that point, if you have a radar available that's going to monitor him, they should have him monitored on radar during the time that he's out of his designated tanker lane. And the fact that he's out of the designated tanker lane is only part of it. He's not only out of the tanker lane, he's out of the Coast Guard marked navigational navigable waters. He's east of that line. The line of light from Bligh Reef buoy to the light on the tip of Busby Island. He's east of that line too. You know, it's when he asked for permission to deviate from that particular line of traffic, which is the west side of that traffic lane, to go to the east side to avoid ice, and he got beyond that. I mean, when he asked to deviate from his designated course, it would seem that a great deal more effort should have been made to keep that vessel in contact and recognize what its positions were.
He was in constant voice contact and constant communications contact with the traffic center as he was departing, and reported no problems other than, and he was given permission to go from the outbound lane, the downbound lane, to the northbound lane, which is a routine procedure. He is still within the allowable bandwidth of tanker traffic, and as there were no other vessels in the area and the visibility was good, he was granted that permission.
He's not in that lane now.
That's correct.
Excuse me? Are the radio communications recorded, and if they are those tapes available, will they be made available to us at some point?
That will be all part of the investigation package.
These NTSB investigations take 4 or 5 months. Can we get some kind of transcript of the communications now?
You'd have to ask NTSB about that.
Commander, did the Coast Guard administer a blood alcohol test to the skipper or to the officers of the ship following the incident?
Routinely or?
In this case.
Yes, we did.
All right.
There are new regulations that came out recently concerning marine casualties, personnel, potential personnel error, personnel action, that the issue of alcohol is now regulatory, and we...
Can you discuss the result?
No, I can't.
How many tests did you conduct on how many people?
Questions are all along these lines are, I think, to be better answered by the National Transportation Safety Board when they arrive tomorrow and start their investigation.
Hmm.
Do I know what?
Do you know how many tests were administered?
Again, that's all part of the investigation, and I think I prefer... Yes, I do. As I said, I think that would be best part of left of the investigation. No, I don't.
Excuse me, ma'am. It sounds as though then the NTSB has assumed responsibility for this investigation.
In this matter, yes, sir.
They've taken it from the Coast Guard then?
I'm not positive as to the actual details as to whether or not they will be doing the sole investigation or whether it will be a joint investigation.
Well, who has jurisdiction over this incident?
In charge of the investigation in Valdez? It will be the National Transportation Board.
If they weren't coming up here, it would be you.
It would be me, yes, it would.
But they're coming up here, so now it's them.
Yes.
And they supersede the Coast Guard then.
The actual particulars of that of that statement, I don't know. I'm not positive myself at this point if they are overriding or superseding us. I have not had a chance to speak with those persons. They will be arriving tomorrow.
The commissioner order them up here? The NTSB commissioner?
I believe so, yes, sir. Yes.
So you're saying it's routine? It is routine right now to take blood alcohol readings, but you're keeping the results secret?
No, I'm just saying that I don't think it would be appropriate to comment in any detail on that until...
And what's the problem in releasing the details?
I think it's just proper to not release that information until all the people involved have been brought up to speed. And
should we assume then that there were positive results? Because if they were negative, wouldn't you just say we tested and it was all negative?
No, I just don't know the results, and I don't want to comment until I have all the information.
Is piloting, is maneuvering or operating a ship a criminal under alcohol, is that a criminal offense or not?
I wouldn't care to say at this time.
Is the U.S. attorney involved at this point?
Not that I'm aware of. No.
Has any oil hit the shoreline yet, and if so, where?
There has been relatively little shoreline contamination. There's been oil on the shore in an area called Reef Island, which is right near where the ship is. The majority of the oil, which we speculate was instantaneously or within an hour after the grounding released, is still in the main part of Prince William Sound. There are no other areas impacted yet.
For example, British Columbia, obviously we're also extremely concerned about this oil spill, and I suppose your environment is ours and ours is yours, but can you tell me, has there been an assessment of what perhaps might occur should there be a drifting southwards, and what in percentage terms is the likelihood of this happening based upon what assessments done today? Has there been a contact with the Canadian Coast Guard? Do you know if there's any precautions being taken by the Canadian Coast Guard, and to what extent?
Okay, there is a representative from the Canadian Coast Guard en route to Valdez to offer his assistance. However, this spill is totally contained within Prince William Sound, and it's a long way from the Canadian shoreline. It's proceeding south within Prince William Sound, south to southwest, but it would probably not, to any great degree, exceed Prince William Sound or leave Prince William Sound and go into the Gulf of Alaska.
Sound, is there sufficient equipment?
Well, right now it's contained just by the fact that there's very light winds and it's not moving very rapidly.
Yeah. But with the weather change?
With the weather change and the equipment that's scheduled to arrive, I believe we'll have a good chance at recovering a large portion of the oil spill. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
What's the impact on wildlife so far?
I think there's representatives from the Fish and Wildlife here, or if not here, they can make themselves available. I know there have been several oil birds, but I do not know, I'm not aware at this time as to the numbers. We've got people from NOAA and from both U.S. and State of Alaska Fish and Wildlife that are taking on that portion of the responsibility in the recovery process. Yes, sir.
I'm Larry Campbell from the Daily News in Anchorage. You can take a break. I got to double check something with Mr. O'Donnell.
Sure. Rick, I'll second that.
Hi. I want to make sure I understand something. You got this barge over there, right?
Right. It's a flat deck barge.
Flat deck barge. What kind of equipment has it got on it?
Normally it contains Connexes that we can store a total of about 10,000 feet of curtain boom, sorbent boom, miscellaneous hoses, fittings, things of that nature. And then it also consists of a power pack unit, crane, and what we call a Vicoma sea skimmer, which is a oil skimmer that can be lowered into the water.
Vicoma goes with the barge?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
How many free skimmers you got? Skimmers that don't need to go with the barge?
That don't need to go to the barge? Let's see, we have a total of around eight of those.
How many?
Eight various other skimmers that are different sizes and for different functions.
So eight that are loose that don't depend on the barge?
That's correct.
How many others that do depend on the barge? Is the Vicoma, any others?
The Vicoma is the prime one that would depend upon the barge.
And how do you get the boom material out there? How do you get the containment boom out there?
Okay, like in the apparatus that we have set up on the flat deck barge, it is stacked inside these connexes in a layered effect to where it can be rapidly deployed by just grabbing one of the ends with a small workboat and pulling it out of the connex itself.
Okay, so let me make sure I got this straight. If your barge is down, you can't get all this mess out there, right?
No, we could take it out of the barge and begin stringing it behind vessels of opportunity, workboats and things of that nature.
Did you try doing that?
Yes, that's a process we put into play. And then we were concerned about the weather. We have a standing safety policy that we will not send small boats like we use around the terminal facility itself outside of Valdez Narrows. We go with the mother or support vessel. In this case, we always use the tugs. We have three of them stationed at the terminal, and as part of our immediate response initiation to this incident, our first concern was to dispatch one of the tugs to the vessel's assistance, which we did. And then the second part of that in communications with the Coast Guard was to begin immediately rounding up all necessary gear that could be used or needed in the lightering process, which went out on another tug.
I'm trying to get at response time here. It took
yes,
you
it
how
was
long?
Yes, it was per our oil spill contingency plan. We followed the plan exactly on how we're supposed to do it, and the only deviation we had from that was the fact that we had taken all this material off of the barge to be able to weld the punctures that were in the bow, and that was the additional response that it took was to be able to put that gear back on the barge.
The contingency plan talks about 5 hours to be on scene, and I'm there, what, 12 hours later, and there's still not a whole lot happening. I'm there 15 hours later, and there's like two skimmers out on the water. And this is not just me noticing it, it's you know, the commissioner of DEC is noticing it. It was a lot of people who were flying around in the air noticing it. They say you guys were slow.
Well, I think our people did an excellent job. They had a lot of material and a lot of equipment that they had to put together to be able to go out on a spill of this size and magnitude, be able to get on station, be able to start deploying that boom, and begin cleanup operations. And I'm proud of the people and the job that they did.
Did they wait until daybreak to do that?
No, sir. This started right at about 1:15 Friday morning that we began pulling all these parts, pieces, and different equipment sets together.
How many hours passed on the scene?
From the time we started the mobilization, a total of right at 10 hours.
I'd like to ask, a couple of things follow up from this. One is, you mentioned that your small boats aren't allowed to go out of Valdez Arm, I believe is what you said?
Yes, we have 21 footers, what we call
Valdez Narrows. And there was plenty of fishing boats, I understand, available from Valdez immediately
yes,
to go out and help. Why couldn't this equipment have been
Well, that's correct. That's exactly what we did. Is again, through that process, we began making contacts with local representatives. For example, we had used back during the Thompson Pass oil spills in January. We started that same process of bringing those vessels under our
The fishing
charge.
Fleet tells me, the fishing fleet here tells me that they made repeated calls and they were told to wait.
No, that's not correct, ma'am.
Yes,
I was in the emergency center to where we took the name and address.
We got about 15 calls yesterday, and I was told we don't know what we're going to do and wait.
And now the number is disconnected.
No, well,
yeah.
I'm sorry, but Mike, sitting in the emergency center, we had a very good response, we felt, from all the communities. We had...
I would need to ask one more question on the barge, and then I have another question.
Okay.
I believe you said that the barge was damaged in a high winds that occurred 2 weeks ago. These aren't the same winds that occurred at the end of January. These are...
Oh, no, these were the... Yes, here locally, and what had happened was a mooring line had parted
okay.
in the vessel.
And since this is the only boat, essentially, that can hold, that is the response boat, I'll say, why was it 2 weeks before repairs were started on this boat?
No, what happened, this is not the only response piece of equipment. We have a Marco Class 7 skimmer, Class 5 skimmer, Class 1 skimmer, and so on and so forth. This particular equipment set is used in a scenario of this nature to where you have a large sudden release of crude oil. So this one is pretty much unique to this type of an event. And as far as, you know, the wind damage, again, what we have to do in a case like this is a vessel that you have to have a certified welder work on it to where we can keep certification on it through the Coast Guard and things of that nature. So it takes a while to get those type of resources up here. At the time, you know, we thought it was a good decision to take the equipment off and begin that repair process.
Okay, one more question for you, and then I have some questions for Mr. Iarassi. Could you explain what, there's 10 tankers on the hook right now off Knoll's Head waiting to come in. Could you explain how this is going to affect oil flow coming down the pipeline, how many days storage capacity you have at the terminal,
When would you would need to get tankers in if you're going to run out of room at the terminal? Since I believe your facility normally supplies 24% of the United States domestic oil supply, do you feel that this is a problem for our national security not being able to get this oil?
Yes, at this point what we have done is we slowed the pipeline down. The normal flow rate is right at 1,900,000 to 2 million barrels per day. Again, we slowed it down to what we take as our first stage approach, which is by dropping some pump stations and went down to 1.2 million. Late evening, we slowed the line down to 800,000 barrels a day, and we have roughly 7 to 8 days of storage capability over at the terminal just by putting it in the tanks.
I understand that your storage capacity is in the crude oil storage tanks, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And I understand that according to the Alyeska design that was originally approved by Congress when the TAPS legislation went into effect, for this phase of throughput, which is 2 million phase 3, 2 million barrels a day or greater, you were supposed to have the Congress approved 32 crude oil storage tanks, and I believe that the number over there is only 18. Could you explain the difference between 18 and 32?
Yes. Okay, the movement of the crude oil depends upon the size of the tanker fleet for your daily throughput rate. So in this particular case, if not having 32 tanks and you only have 18, what that tells me is that you have a better movement of the tankers between West Coast discharge ports. In other words, you have more tankers in the trade. You're able to handle those on a more expeditious basis as far as the loading and the discharging process are concerned in that operation.
But I understand that the number of crude oil storage tanks actually had more to do with preventing, having the storage capacity to prevent a slowdown in pipeline throughput in case there was a slowdown in tanker traffic. Now, twice already this year, we've seen a slowdown in tanker traffic. Once in January when there was a large storm, and now again. And you didn't finish answering my questions about how this would affect national security, having this slowdown in oil flow.
I can't answer that from a local basis here. It comes down to, again, the operation is when the tankers were here, if we can forecast that we were going to run into those storm problems, which we did, we took steps to slow the production down at Prudhoe Bay, slow the pipeline down, rather than shut down that entire operation. It's much better to slow the production down the field and keep everything warm and online than it is to shut it completely in.
So, the point was there's supposed to be sufficient oil storage capacity there so you would not have to slow down the pipeline throughput at all. This is why there was 32 crude oil storage tanks.
That was not the original reason, as I understood it, why we were 32 tanks versus 18 tanks.
Okay, well then I think maybe that needs to be looked into.
I gotta make sure I got something straight here. Okay, number of skimmers, all right? Number of skimmers out on the water. How many were there yesterday afternoon, let's say?
Let's see. I'd have to say right around 5 to 6 working.
That's about what I
think. Class 5, Class 7, Camaras, and Sea Skimmer.
5 to 6 working, all at the same time?
Yes.
And that's what you promised the state you'd have out there? 5, right? A minimum of 5?
No, again, we respond with our oil spill contingency gear begin the cleanup, the mechanical cleanup process as we were mobilizing the additional equipment that we could through Exxon. We were able to mobilize additional equipment to be flown up, and we started processes of trucks with boom and additional skimming equipment coming from co-ops within the state of Alaska, both Ciro, ACS. That's what we're doing.
Not within
the process
of
doing. I'm sorry?
Not within 5 hours.
No. Again, because of the problem that we had with the barge and the other skimmers and everything went out in that package with the mothership, which was one of the tugs, the Pathfinder, as the prime mover, if you will, to get it out there.
And it took you, that problem added a couple hours to your response time.
It added that 5 hours.
Added about 5 hours to your response time.
That's correct. It added 5 hours to our response time.
That's why you couldn't get the boom stuff out there.
Well, that's why it took us 10 hours total to get it there.
10 hours to get it out there.
Right. Normal was 5 to 6 hours to respond, and it took us 10.
Yeah. So you couldn't meet what you couldn't do what you promised the state you could do.
In this particular incident, was because we had had the barge unloaded, that contributed to our slower response time. That, ma'am, I really don't have off the top of my head. We have various vessels out there. We have barges, and we're using tanks on the tugs and so on and so forth, and I don't have an accurate count at this point.
Gas?
No, I really don't.
Could I follow up one more question with Mr. Alyeska? Actually, it's a follow-up point and a question. One is, maybe you could explain, the oil industry right now taxes, generates 85% of the state's revenue. Maybe you could explain what this slowdown in pipeline throughput, how that would impact the state's revenue. And I believe also that the changes at the terminal from 18 to 32, from 32 to 18, that difference in crude oil storage tanks has not been approved by Congress or by DEC or by anyone. Is that correct?
Ma'am, I really don't know. I mean, that's...
I think you do. But anyway, how about the state's revenue?
Again,
who would know?
It just sure isn't me. I'm sorry.
Okay. I have a few questions for Mr. Iarassi, and then I'll let everybody else go. I'll just go with one question.
This is a live broadcast from Valdez, Alaska, a press conference with Jack Iarassi, president of Exxon Shipping, Chuck O'Donnell of the Alaska Marine, the Alyeska Marine Terminal Superintendent, and there has been also Steve McCall of the Coast Guard. Dr. Ricky Ott of Cordova CDFU is now questioning Jack Iarassi.
Situation. Could it be boomed?
At
is it too late to boom it?
It's boomed. It's boomed. Yes, as of 11 o'clock this morning, they were closing the boom. Oh, wait. Yeah, yes. If you were out there at 8 or 9 or 10 o'clock, it was not boomed. As of 11 o'clock this morning, just before I left the control room to proceed to come over here, we took control of that part of it, and we said close the loop on the ship. So if you're responding to what you saw at 8, 9, 10 o'clock, you did not see the boom. At 11 o'clock, I personally told them to make sure before we try the next lightering attempt that that vessel is totally boomed. They told me they had given the order to the ship and to the boat that's out there with the boom to close the loop.
I think the industry is very pleased
yes,
to see that
boats.
Some effort is made.
There was a boom and it was trailing straight off behind it, but it certainly wasn't in a circle around it.
Well, from the time we in the control room say get that boom around the ship, I can't tell you what process it goes through. Okay, well, we're not going to attempt the next lightering activity until it is boomed. Now, just let me tell you, there's one concern about booming, and you have to understand why booming is not, in many cases, a good idea. If you've been close to the main oil slick, you know it's giving off a lot of gas. And it's a great concern when you boom a vessel and there still is oil coming at it, that you create a gas pocket around that ship. And we have been concerned up to this point that as long as there was no oil coming out of the vessel, everything had stabilized, we really didn't want the boom there. Once we started the lightering operation early this morning and we saw the release of oil, then we decided that we would not take on the next lightering until we had boomed it. Now, we got to do this very carefully. That means that once we boom it, we've got to be very, very careful that any release is stopped immediately, because what you're doing with that boom is you're containing all of that, any oil that's released right around the vessel. So you're creating an enormous gas pocket. So that's one of the concerns. It's one of the things we have to do very, very carefully. We are just very worried about the million barrels on the ship, and we've got to proceed very, very carefully in getting it off. We have taken full financial responsibility, and that means any legitimate claims, please bring them to the claims management team, and they're going to take care of any legitimate claims.
$100 million.
We are willing to take care of any legitimate claims. We have put no arbitrary limit
We have no arbitrary limit.
Mr. Iorossi?
The one thing we need to be concerned about, the only thing we're going to look into is it a legitimate claim? If it's a legitimate claim resulting from this incident, there'll be compensation.
Pardon? Who decides that?
There is a claims management team. We've got about six or seven teams. There's an Exxon coordinator with that team, and there is at least one outside firm that's been brought in to handle the insurance claims, and we'll have other firms involved in that. So that's an activity that'll be going on with everything else.
I asked last night if anything's being done to protect the creeks and the bays where the large stocks are, protect the Esther hatchery.
Yes, we've taken in priority the salvage activity, the containment of the main slick, and starting 2 o'clock this afternoon, and hopefully you'll be there, there'll be a meeting of representatives of different fishing groups, and you're going to help us select those sites and the priority we go about protecting it. So we are absolutely conscious of that and are moving to do that. You know, we are just about now got the full team mobilized, and we're beginning to, you'll see a lot more activity going on now, and a lot of different things going on. If I can just limit it to maybe two more questions, because I'm losing touch with what's going on while I'm here.
What's the estimated?
And remember, I got to be back here at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock.
What's the estimated dollar?
Yes, ma'am, you have one.
Yes, what's the estimated dollar damage to the ship, the value of the oil, and the estimated cost of cleanup at this point?
See, I haven't even stopped to figure it out. 240,000 barrels, and I don't know what oil is going at now, $20 a barrel. So you can figure that part out. The ship, we haven't even begun to assess the damage. You know, we just have that very initial underwater survey, and all we have is some very murky photographs, which don't help us too much. So we need the video survey that's going on, should be going on now or this afternoon. That'll tell us more. The vessel is a brand new ship, built in 1986. It was actually delivered in December of 86, and it's been in operation for 26 months, all of that time in Valdez. So it is the latest addition to the U.S. flag tanker fleet. And we're certainly going to try to save it. We have no idea. A lot depends upon the success of the dispersion activities and the ignition activities. Yes, ma'am, in the back.
Please invite who's ever responsible for the marine life to the 5 o'clock press conference. I think it would be nice to be able to address questions to them about the marine life and the sound.
Okay, maybe somebody can do that. I understand the impact is very minimal at this point, but you know, this is a constantly progression thing. I'm going to take one more and then call it quits. Yes, sir.
Mr. Iorossi? Again, my name is Jack Lamb. I'm with Cordova District Fishermen United. You said that you would be contacting fishing organizations. From 9 o'clock yesterday morning, we've made everybody that's possible aware that we have unlimited vessels available for any kind of assistance as needed. But also, and
you know, we've been inundated with help. Our problem is to set up a priority plan.
I understand
that's been going on. And the gentleman right here, Alan Mackey, he's going to be chairing that 2 o'clock session, and he'll be taking all of the advice we can get as to how to prioritize the sensitive areas.
Okay, I understand that. Also, I don't know if, to my understanding, the oil spill contingency response plan was formulated in 76 and 77, and that's still the one that they operate off of. And rather than bring the whole document with me from Cordova this morning, I brought just copies of significant parts of it. And it identifies specific areas and specific responses necessary to protect several of those different bays and so forth.
Yes, that's what we're going to be talking about, Jack. What we need to factor in is, where is the slick right now? And how do you prioritize all those areas, because you can't do them all at once. So we need to begin to prioritize and getting your best input as to where do we begin first, and that's what we need to do.
Okay, I guess at this point then I'm saying that I, representing CDFU, am here to assist any way I can.
Well, we need all the help. We need all the help we can.
All right.
And we'll certainly be looking for the help. The problem we've had is getting organized to absorb it all. You know, up to this point we've had more help than we can handle. But right now we're getting ourselves fully organized, and we'll begin to take in your comments and thoughts and to actually work on them. You know, no sense in giving us advice until we've got an ability to do something about it, which I feel we have that growing ability. So we'll be looking. I understand your concern. If I were you, I'd be just as concerned. We just need to get your input. Okay, thanks, folks. We'll be back 6 o'clock.
That was Jack Irasi, the president of Exxon Shipping, at a press conference. You've been listening to, we've been broadcasting this live from the Valdez Civic Center in Valdez, Alaska. Early in the press conference, Jack Irasi, again, president of Exxon Shipping, gave the latest status, the discovery through last night and this morning by divers of additional damage previously undetected to the Exxon Valdez, which is still hard aground on Bly Reef, about 25 miles southwest of Valdez. The damage is sufficient to prevent the ship from being floated in its current condition. Efforts this morning to begin lightering or pumping the remaining oil off the vessel were not successful. That has been on hold until the vessel can be completely circled by booms, and then additional lightering efforts will be conducted. Also at the press conference today, Commander Steve McCall, the commander of the Coast Guard station in Valdez, responded to several questions about the radar system being used, but refused specifically to answer questions regarding a breathalyzer or blood alcohol test given to the commander, captain of the vessel, the Exxon Valdez, and also indicated that the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, will be sending a team here tomorrow, arriving in Valdez, and will be conducting at least part of the investigation and maybe superseding the Coast Guard's efforts in that regard. The press conference has concluded. There are about 125 people were here, many of them fishermen from the Valdez and Cordova commercial fisheries groups, pressing question after question, not only about remuneration, but specifically about why the published plan for spill response was apparently not acted upon or not acted upon quickly enough. There'll be additional press conferences throughout the day. As we're aware of the schedules, we'll be continuing to broadcast press conferences from the Civic Center live. For KCHE Radio News, I'm Dave Hammack. Back to the studio.